Hey there, everybody. It is Wednesday, March 7th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us an email, sending on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you, as always, this week, and we're going to welcome our first guest. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Sure.
All right, let me introduce you. Avi Sher was born in New York City and raised in Israel. He returned to New York to study at the School of American Ballet for 8 years, where he had the opportunity to perform Fritz and the Nutcracker Prince with the New York City Ballet in the Nutcracker for 4 seasons. He has danced with 11 different companies in 6 years, including Sacramento Ballet, Washington Ballet, Joffrey Ballet, Los Angeles Ballet. If I left one out, it's a very important ballet company, and it's great. He's danced with them all. His first professional choreography commission came at 18 years old when he created a piece for the American Ballet Theater and a piece for Miami City Ballet. Since then, his works have been seen all over the world. Dance Magazine recognized his choreography by naming him one of the top 25 to watch. In 2009, his company, Avi Sher and Dancers, debuted at Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival and danced its first New York City season at the Alvin Ailey Citigroup Theater in 2010, as well as appearing at the Kennedy Center later that year. The third annual Avi Sher and Dancers New York City season kicks off on April 7th. Avi, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you very much.
I'm exhausted
just listening to that.
You did all of those things. 11 companies in 6 years.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about that.
Were there mornings that you woke up and you thought, I have absolutely no idea which company I am in right now?
Or which city I was in, company. Yeah, or where I was going to be tomorrow. Yeah, definitely. It was a hectic, crazy time, but it was very exciting. You know, it was an unusual experience to do that much in a short amount of time.
Now, and I should, in full disclosure, I should tell our listeners, because I get in trouble when I don't reveal that I have met people before. I did work for 1 year at the School of American Ballet when Avi was there as a student, so we have a little previous knowledge.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. All right, so let's back up. We got to back up a ton. In the broadest possible terms, Avi Sher, what is dance to you?
Wow, that is a tough question. I mean, dance to me is just an expression, a way of expressing yourself. You know, it's like you sort of feel so many things, and then you can't even speak about it because it's not something you can exactly pinpoint, and then you just start to dance and all the emotions just kind of come out of you, you know, and you can't, it's not something you can narrowly define. It's just something that you, it happens when you're doing it.
And what are your earliest dance memories?
My earliest dance memories are probably being about 5 years old and like begging my parents to let me study dance and having a video of a ballet of the Nutcracker in the house and putting it on in Israel, so it was a little unusual that we even had the Nutcracker, and just jumping around the living room and flying around the house and trying to just imitate what I saw in the video.
And was dance culture in Israel much different than it is in the U.S.?
Oh, for sure. I mean, at the time, there wasn't really very much. I mean, now Israel has a kind of a much more vibrant contemporary dance scene. A lot of like people are now known internationally, but at the time, in the late 80s, early 90s, there wasn't a lot going on there. And on the ballet side, kind of almost like today, unfortunately, there really was not very much at all. So it was very unusual. And my family was also Orthodox, so it was even more unusual.
A little
really
bit, yeah.
Yeah, it was just really odd. Luckily, my parents were just very supportive, but I don't really know where it came from or how I was exposed to it because it was nowhere around me, that's for sure.
What about ballet versus modern versus jazz? What is it about ballet in particular that speaks to you?
I mean, I just kind of like the elegance of it. You know, even if you're not doing something that's really classical in ballet, if you're doing something more contemporary ballet or more, you know, really sort of electronic music or whatever, just the way of moving from a ballet vocabulary has like an implied, you know, elegance and stature to it. That to me, modern dance just doesn't have. Like, it's just modern dance has a more pedestrian quality, which is beautiful in its own way, but I think what I respond to the most is that sort of like other earthly feeling that a ballet dancer has, where they're moving not like a regular person could possibly move.
Right. Now answer this once and for all. We will take your answer as the definitive answer. Okay. Do the ballet people and the modern dance people get along?
Do I have to give a one-word answer?
You have the official answer. Do they get along, or is it really a Sharks and Jets kind of thing happening?
Is this like the Real Housewives of...
That would be amazing. We should work on that, you and I.
We should work on that. Yeah, we should definitely. Do they get along? I'm going to say they get along.
Okay.
Are they friends? No. But they get along, yes.
Now, if you're in a place and you're suddenly surrounded by modern dancers, are you instantly uncomfortable?
I'm a little defensive, to be honest, because sometimes you do feel like, because frankly, the ballet companies just have much bigger budgets, and I'm like doing my small little projects. You know, there's tons of little modern dance projects that probably can't raise the kind of funds I'm raising because I'm working with ballet dancers who are well known from ballet companies, and I do encounter a lot of, you know, just hostility because of that.
Yes. All right. So we got to, hopefully this will dispel that and you guys can all get along. Cause I think this radio
exactly.
show, yeah, I think this is the way to do it. So then at some point, as early as 18 years old, you said, I'm not just going to dance the dances that are put in front of me. I'm going to choreograph.
Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to do my own thing. I mean, back to when I was even just like a little tiny kid before I really started studying, I always was making up my own little dances and, you know, sort of doing what I wanted to do to the music. And then once I got older and learned like the more formalized vocabulary, I still have that impulse to just, you know, hear music and just kind of start doing something. And, you know, I just always knew that I wanted to pursue that kind of the way I always knew I wanted to dance. So when I was 16, I got my first little opportunity at the school to make a piece for the choreographic workshop. And I just kind of connected to it instantly and was like, oh, this is as good as I thought it would be, you know, as enjoyable as I thought it would be. And so, you know, and then when I just kind of really aggressively pursued it from 16, and then, like, you know, about not even 2 years later when I was 18, it was like a year and a half, I got that, you know, I really just didn't stop until I got an opportunity, and then the ABT one really materialized. So I just kind of went for it, you know?
And how would you describe your choreographic voice as an individual? How does it differ from other people's works?
I don't know. That's a really hard question to answer because I feel like I do different kinds of things. Like I'll use all music from all over the map and try different things. I mean, so I don't know. It's hard for me to sort of sum up my style in a word, but I know I'm definitely very musical. I'm always very tied to the music. You know, I'm trying to interpret the music's general feeling and interpret it sort of note for note, you know, and sort of just really feel like the music and the dance, like, I want people to feel like there's no other possible way that music could have been interpreted, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that for me, when I feel I've done that is when I feel I've been successful, because I feel like if I picked a piece of music that I really love and makes me very emotional for whatever, in whatever way, if I sort of marry the dance to it, and the dance will give you that too.
Well, we had Tyler Engel, who I'm sure you know.
He was in the show last year.
Look at that. He was on this show, Is So Gay, years ago, and he was a soloist at the time. And then shortly after he was on this show, Is So Gay, he was promoted to principal dancer. And I would imagine that those two have something to do with each other.
For sure.
For sure. Yeah, because I
you're not the first one to say that.
Yes, boys all over the country know that just calling into this show really increases their chances, because I think Peter Martins is a big fan of this show. I think it's a part of his weekly routine.
Yeah.
Well,
I think Alistair McCauley also wrote something about that.
Let's talk about, actually, before we talk about Tyler, let's talk about Alistair for a second, because I had this very unique opportunity to work at the School of American Ballet, and so many of you that I had the opportunity to work with have gone on to be principals and notable choreographers. And so I read Alistair's columns in the New York Times, and sometimes I read them and I think, does this guy really like dance? And I struggle sometimes. I can't even imagine reading. Do you all read his columns religiously?
I don't know about the actual dancers, you know, who he's speaking. He's never reviewed me personally, so I haven't personally, you know, gone one way or the other with him. I definitely find his opinions very interesting. Sometimes I totally agree, sometimes I totally don't. And I think that reading critical, you know, writing, you have, if you can take it with a grain of salt, you have a lot to learn, whether you completely agree or not. But sometimes, yeah, I have borne the brunt of it from other writers. And it can be very, very detrimental to your work. So I'm guessing that a lot of them probably stay away.
Oh yeah. I would imagine so. I would imagine so. But back to Tyler. So when Tyler was on the show, we had a whole conversation. We actually get emails from listeners all over the country, and people were excited that Tyler was on, and they wrote in and said, young men who said, I really want to take ballet, but my parents won't let me take ballet because they assume that I'm going to be bullied and they assume I'm going to be made fun of. That's still a very present concept for boys all over the country, is it not?
I think so. I mean, I live in my little New York City bubble, you know, so, but I'm pretty sure that is still a big problem in other places in the country. Yeah, I would be surprised if it wasn't.
And what do you have to say as a notable choreographer to parents out there who are saying, no, I can't possibly let my boy do ballet because it'll just make him gay?
Well, I mean, obviously I would tell them that if your son's gay, he's going to be gay at some point, no matter what you were told from him early on in life, you know, like it's not something that you can prevent. It's something that eventually you're just going to have to embrace in order to have your son be happy and to have a real relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of shielding him from things that he wants to do at a young age is something that you'll both probably one day regret.
And another topic that we discussed are choreographers and directors, that there are choreographers and directors, not you, of course, who have some reluctance to putting gay men in the straight romantic lead, which strikes me as a little bizarre.
Is that true? I think that, you know, I mean, sometimes I encounter male dancers who are very effeminate in the way that they dance, and that does hold their career back. And I don't know if I think that's necessarily bad, because the audience does have to believe that there is a romance happening up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can't sort of play that for whatever reason, then that is an issue, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that's like a prejudice thing. I think it's just that it has to look like Romeo and Juliet if it is Romeo and Juliet. I wish that there was more choreography that embraced the type of dancers that don't fit into that mold and showcase what they can do. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
I think there should be more of that. But I think that, you know, people can do what they can do, you know? And
so you got to play the part.
You have to play the part. I mean, there are gay guys I know who are very masculine on stage, you know, and so that's great. But if you're not masculine at all, it can be hard to put you into that kind of role. But it doesn't mean there's not plenty of other things for you to do that an audience can really connect to.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, we do have to talk about your musical selections for this week's episode.
Okay.
You ready to talk about your music? Because this is very interesting because I know that so much of your choreography, I was reading all these interviews that you've done where your choreography, as you said, is so inspired by music.
Definitely.
So this is the part of the show, Avi, where you tell our listening audience what some of your song selections say about Avi Scher. You get to do a little self-analysis.
Awesome. It's like free therapy.
Exactly. Except you are laying on the couch, so it's great. You get to analyze yourself. And, you know, I may or may not charge you. We'll see how this works out.
Okay.
All right.
I have insurance now, so...
Well, so here, we will start with, and I don't really know all of these songs. We'll do three of your songs, and you're going to tell us what they say about you. Let's start with Animal by Mike Snow. What does Animal say about Avi Scher?
Well, Avi, do you know that song?
I don't know that song.
It's a really great song, and one of the references is, I change shapes, but I'm still an animal.
Mm.
And I just like that line because it's like, you can kind of just like, put on any kind of appearances for whoever's around, but you're still you, kind of, you know?
Nice.
And it just has a very kind of like techno-y / alternative indie sound to it. And I think it's just an interesting song. It's the kind of song that gets you going, but then you kind of think about the words and you're like, this is really kind of cool, like this message, you know?
Awesome. All right.
Yeah.
One down. What does Crash Your Party say about Avi? He's already chuckling. What does Crash Your Party say about Avi?
It's just like she says, you think you're the star of the show, and I'm about to let you know. It's my favorite line from that song. And it's kind of just like, it's just a really fun song about just like, it's, you know, showing people who you are and what you have. You know, like, it's like, you think you know something, but wait till you see me.
Nice.
That's what I take from that. And it's just, it kind of just gets you moving, that song as well. Like, it's a fun song, but you're like, you know, this is super corny, but actually, you think that this is a good message for me. Like, I'm taking something from this.
Awesome.
So, I like it.
right, one more to go. Now, I know that you get confused for Beyonce all the time. I know that's a struggle for you. What does Beyonce's 4 say about Avi Scher?
Beyonce, I just love Beyonce. She's so fun. Like, I just, you know, it's just some music just put on and it just makes you smile. And I think that song, it just has so many different changing rhythms. Like, it kind of just keeps throwing you for a loop. Like, oh, now she's doing this and now she's doing that. And my favorite part is when she says, me and my boo riding. It's so much fun. Because I try to picture me, like, my boyfriend, you know, being all cool, like, me and my boo riding. It just doesn't really work because we're not as cool as her, but it's fun to think about.
Do we want, we could pause on that visual for a second.
Yeah, like, I try to picture, like Beyonce and Jay-Z, kind of like when they're walking down the street and everyone's like thinking of, you know, those videos, and it's like slow motion and they're just like walking and everyone around them's like, ah. And I try to picture us kind of just doing that and everyone's like, oh my God. Bobby and his boyfriend.
Now when we go and see your dancing, that's what we're going to be looking for.
The slow motion walking?
Absolutely.
I should add that in actually now that you said that.
So April 7th, we got the third season kicking off. This is pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's the third one. So every year it's like, you know, it feels like, it's like, wow, it's happening again.
and
making it happen again.
And what is going to stand out for people in this third season? What are people going to see?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the main events is this new duet I'm making for Herman Cornejo from ABT and Misa Coronaga from Boston Ballet.
Of course.
They're just an incredible pair, and they've sort of become known for dancing together all over the world in little guest appearances. But this is the first time they danced together in New York, and the first time they had a work made specifically for them. And it has live guitar music, classical guitar, but sort of very sensual, and it sort of kind of breaks down a relationship dynamic in sort of a past, present, future in sort of a mixed-up order, which I think is kind of was an interesting way to approach it. So that, I think, will be really exciting. It'll be the two of them will just knock it out of the park. And then I have I actually have one piece that has a slight gay twist.
So yay!
I actually have two pieces that have it. One is sort of like a Will and Grace twist, and the other one is just like a two men. It's not a twist. It's just two men. So
fantastic.
So that should be fun, too. I haven't really explored that too much because it's taken a while to sort of feel like I could do it in a way that would work. And so I feel this year like I sort of had an idea of how to make it work. So I'm trying one is sort of on the lighter side, and one is just a little, not heavier, but just normal. You know, like it's just like a non-issue, just like two men.
Might I suggest a piece entitled This Ballet is So Gay?
I think that, yeah, that's probably what I'll put on the poster.
Okay. That's, I mean, you don't even have to credit me. This is free, free. I'm giving this out free.
And then I'm going to put rinse and repeat.
It's like he knows. It's like he knows. So now where can folks go, Avi, to learn all about the amazing choreography that you, sir, are doing?
Best place is my website, avischer.com. And tickets will be on sale tomorrow. And, Avischer, AVISCHER.com. And there's, like, photos and videos and preview clips and little blurbs about the dancers and all that fun stuff.
Oh, it's great. I have to say, as I said to Tyler, I just think it's so incredible seeing the amazing work that you all are putting out there. I mean, I know it must be difficult to credit all of this back to me in my 1 year at the School of American Ballet, because I'm sure you guys have your own talents. But it is incredible. I'm just so unbelievably proud of everything that you're doing.
Well, you know, I think I've credited you in other radio interviews I've done other places. When I was dancing for Tulsa Ballet, there was a show there called This Is So Gay. And the show So Gay at Tulsa. I don't know if you're familiar with that branch. So,
I don't. I got to get new affiliates, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I think Rick Santorum was on the show with me that day.
I would pay to see that.
Yeah, and I told him all about you, so he should be calling you any moment.
Yes, I will wait by the phone.
He'll be calling in for the show.
Well, you got your third season. As we said, the third annual Avi Scher and Dancer season kicks off on April 7th at Ailey City Group Theater. Avi, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. All the best with this season.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's beyond, and hopefully I'll see you there.
Sounds good. We'll see you at the ballet.
All right, thanks, Ken.
Bye, Avi.
Bye.
Dreaming, now I'm supposed to fill it up with something.
All right, folks, welcome back. We are ready to welcome a second guest. Hey, second guest, are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
I figured you would be ready. Christopher Hines began his career in the Bay Area as a reporter for the Oakland Tribune and San Francisco Chronicle newspapers. He was an embedded journalist with a Marine helicopter squadron reporting from the front line in Kuwait. He then started his own production company, Rogue Culture, to develop a wide range of programming. His previous films include The Butch Factor, which explored issues of masculinity, The Adonis Factor, which looked at the importance of body image, and Legalize Gay, which captured the courage and passion of a new generation of activists in the campaign for LGBT equality. His newest film, Man to Man, A Gay Man's Guide to Finding Love, which features various experts, matchmakers, the founders of Grindr and Manhunt, even stand-up comedian Ant, who was on the show way back when. They are all talking about finding Mr. Right and keeping him. Christopher Hines, welcome to the show, Is So Gay.
Well, thanks for having me.
How are things out there?
Good, good. Just been busy promoting the film and working on some others, and very happy to be on the show.
Now tell me the differences between reporting from the front line in Kuwait and living in California.
Well, there's both sand, but that's the same. No.
Quite the experience. I think you're our first embedded journalist in 4 years of the show.
Well, yeah, that was completely a different experience, you know, very visual and, you know, rush, adrenaline. All part of storytelling. I got to really know the guys and were able to tell their stories and had confidence in me. And, you know, there was the danger factor as well, but.
Absolutely.
It's definitely a different experience. There is adrenaline high to it and everything, but there's also something to be said, you know, for taking a step back and taking a less visceral approach to storytelling and everything. So,
I would imagine that your family had some hesitance about you going and being an embedded journalist. My family would not allow that, Christopher.
Yeah, I know. Guys can get pretty driven, and when they want, you know, that was like the as a reporter, that's kind of like the ultimate, war reporting is kind of like the ultimate experience, the ultimate dream, you know, the drama and the danger and, you know, the ratings and,
quite the experience. But you did come back, you came back, and then you started your own production company and decided to focus on the medium of film. Talk to us about that particular art form and why the medium of film appeals to you to tell stories.
Well, I think it's such a visual. I mean, I love writing and I read all the time, but I think visually it has a very powerful impact on people. And I've always been visually driven and kind of taking the written narrative and then adding visuals and sound and everything to it, I think is a very powerful form of storytelling. So that's what I'm really drawn to. And I love, you know, storytelling in all forms, whether, you know, it's the guy selling shoes, I could listen to him all day. And I think people will sit around the campfire for a good story. And that's what I always try to do.
We've had documentary filmmakers on the show before, and they spoke quite passionately about just the medium in particular of documentary films, that you're talking to real people and you're talking about real issues. But one of the challenges that folks have articulated is that you don't always know what people are going to say, even as you really want to control what they're about to say. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't really try to. I kind of go with the narrative, what I'm looking for, and I don't try to control too much what they say. I do clean people up as far as, you know, edits. I mean, a lot of people, like I'm speaking now, lots of I thinks, you know, that kind of thing. I do try to take those out and clean people up, but I do go with an idea of what I want and, you know, the thrust of it, but then I love surprises, and that's the originality of, you know, you never know what people are going to tell you, and trying to capture what would be of interest and, you know, what's the most just interesting aspect of what they're saying, and with always an eye to your audience. I mean, that's the thing I think about documentary filmmaking is that, yes, you may have a personal passion for doing something and it may be something that you're in love with and stuff, but always the audience. Is this going to connect with the audience? Are they going to care? You know, and that's kind of the key factors to striving to be a good documentary producer.
Well, with these four documentaries, I mean, you're hitting on masculinity, you're hitting on body image, you're hitting on LGBT equality, and now with this newest film, you're talking about relationships in the gay community. How much of yourself do you see in these films? What's your learning curve? Are you a thing apart from these movies, or are you, as a human making them, are you learning something about yourself as well?
Well, I learn something about myself all the time when I do these films, but I thought I wanted to take the skills that I had learned, you know, because I've worked for CNN and MTV Networks and VH1, and I've done all kinds of programming for them as well. And I wanted to take these skills and apply them to some gay-themed programming, you know, and make documentaries that people actually who don't usually watch documentaries would watch and be entertained and say, hey, I want to watch that, you know. And so I thought there were some key themes, and plus do documentary films that all gay men could sit down and watch together, because we do seem to divide ourselves in our community, you know, whether it's, you know, from bears to muscle boys to twinks to, you know, we seem to subdivide ourselves a lot. So I was trying to do some documentaries that would reach all of these different groups. And I thought, well, the first one that always seemed to be was masculinity, which is something that we all seem to struggle with or judge each other by, or and I thought I wanted to kind of address that issue. And then the second one, obviously, was body image, which, you know, looks, which I think we all agree is a rather important, prominent factor in the gay community. And then the third one was relationships, which I think, you know, a lot of gay men say they want to be in a long-term relationship, but a lot of us struggle to maintain that, and I wanted to explore that. And then I was fortunate with Legalized Gay, because Logo, these Butch Factor and Don's Factor have been on Logo, and Logo, I approached them about doing a political film, and they love the idea because there's a whole new generation, both gay and straight, that are out there pushing for equality in all over the country. So I thought that was the, you know, one really that I wanted to do. So with these four, I feel fortunate that I've been able to do some films that I personally find interesting, but also that the audience seems to like. And so hopefully someday we'll do a box set.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be fun, right? Oh, this is my Christopher Hines box set.
Yes.
It's a stocking stuffer. So let's talk about Man to Man. So I watched this week. Talk to us a bit about the origins of this particular topic.
Well, Origin is a statistic showing a survey done by the University of California, Los Angeles, that 80% of gay men say they want to be in a long-term relationship, a loving long-term relationship, but only about a third of them are, compared to two-thirds of straight men. So what was the disconnect? You know, what is it that, as we all know, we all have our friend, everybody says they want to be in a long-term loving relationship, but it seems like a lot of us struggle with that. So I thought that's an issue to explore.
Now, you had probably five or six. So you had the relationship experts, and you had Ant, who is hilarious. We love Ant. But then you had five or six average people, you know, normal Joes looking for love. Now, I know the difficulty is you can't represent everyone, and I understand that. But you in particular had some urban gays. How much do you think that their experiences represented gay men all over the country?
I think, obviously, if you live in an urban environment, it's different. But I do think with social media and everything, gay men that live, you know, in the country or small towns, I think they're a lot more connected now.
Yeah.
And they know what's going on. And I think they travel a lot in between Scruff and Grindr and Growler and Facebook and all that. I think that disconnect is kind of disappearing a little bit, I think.
Yeah. And I will also say, and this is kind of interesting, given the Adonis factor, these were all particularly well-built, in good shape men, would you say?
Well, I don't know. I guess. What are you saying? You're saying that they were all too good-looking? Is that what you're saying?
They were very good. No, is there such a thing as too good-looking? I have absolutely no idea. But I did find it interesting that these men, I actually liked making that connection between, okay, the assumption is these are extraordinarily attractive men in great shape. Of course they can find somebody else. And so I thought it was quite lovely to feature these men who were struggling, you know, finding relationships just like everybody else.
Well, I thought they were good looking. I mean, I was trying to get a diversity.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends. I didn't think they were all, I don't want people to think that they're all like cover models or anything.
No.
And they were different types and different. So I didn't really think they were, you know, just doing details models or something.
Right, right.
I guess the thing is that, you know, we kind of touch on too is, you know, looks. That's one part of the film is, you know, looks are a very driving factor in gay men and how they choose partners or relationships and stuff. But it doesn't always lead to long-term relationships. You know, sometimes it's a real balance between the visual and somebody that you want to go home to every night, you know. And, you know, as men, we get very obsessive about things, and looks is one of those. So, you find a lot of good-looking gay men that are single, and, you know, and you wonder why, you know, and it's
right.
always that kind of, what is it, a bunch of 10s looking for an 11, you
right.
know?
Right. Well, the other interesting thing I thought with the average Joes that were in the film was that the ones that spoke about their past and about their families, a lot of them had these struggles. You had some experts talking about second adolescences and gay men who are in that search to, you know, repair being marginalized earlier in their home life, in their family life, in their adolescence. And I'm kind of curious, if you were to make this documentary in 10 years, as we see the reports that families are becoming more and more accepting, you know, and they're not, the gay men, younger gay men are not struggling as much. I'm curious if that concept of a second adolescence will affect dating going out.
Well, I hope so. I think that I hope as we progress. I mean, I interviewed Alan Downs, who's a famous psychologist and author, and he wrote The Velvet Rage, you know, Growing Up Gay in a Straight Man's World, and
yes.
the effect that has on our ability to have relationships. And I do think if we grew up, you know, if we could sexually explore in our teens and everything like everybody else does, you know, and not struggle with this, and, you know, the prejudice from our family and society and all that, that definitely has an impact on, you know, your ability to have intimate relationships and also your search for validation,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes you're searching for too much validation from your partner and stuff. And then this delayed adolescence, because if you're not coming out, if you're not coming out to your 19, 20, 21, which is, you know, a lot younger than it was in the past, but then still you don't have all those teen years where, you know, straight guys are romping around and doing their thing and,
right.
you know, exploring. But then you got gay guys coming out in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, less so now than in the past, but and then they're just becoming kids all over again. So it's like being a kid in a candy store. So they're not in a place, you know, they got to get all this out of their system sexually. So they're not in a place to be where you need to be to establish a long-term relationship.
Right. Now, there were two different views presented in the film. There were some of the experts were saying, look, there's something, as we were just discussing, there's something fundamentally different about being a gay man, searching for another gay man. And then on the other side, you had, which I enjoyed immensely, you featured a pair of couples towards the end of the film. And one of the men in the couples said, there's really no difference which gender you are with. A relationship is a relationship is a relationship. And it provided nice fodder. I've actually been talking about this with people today of, so does it make a difference, or is a relationship a relationship is a relationship?
Well, I did profile the Gay Couples Institute in San Francisco, which was established a few years back based on the same principles as the Gottman Institute, which is it's in Seattle. It's for straight couples. And they have this almost, you know, scientific detailing of what breaks down relationships. And they found that, you know, straight relationships are very similar to gay relationships, and what are the challenges and the fundamentals to maintaining and, you know, and the challenges of a relationship. So, yes, they are very similar. There are two differences, though, is that a gay relationship seem to be much more open talking about sex than straight relationships, you know, like sexual attraction with other people and that kind of thing. And there seems to be more of a sense of humor in gay and lesbian relationships than in straight relationships in dealing with these issues.
Right.
I actually found that there could be two advantages, especially for gay men, you know, because, you know, as gay men, we can say, hey, that guy's hot without our partner freaking out for the most time, you know, for the most part. Plus, we're much more open about monogamy and different forms of it and all that kind of stuff, which does not exist in straight relationships for the most part. And then also you're kind of marrying someone more similar to you. You know, you might share the same shaving kit, or you have the same interests, you know, same clothes. So we already have two things that I think give us the ability to maybe even have more long-term relationships than straight couples.
Right.
Of course, you know, straight couples aren't really providing much of a role model now. I mean, 50% of marriages, you know, straight marriages end in divorce, so...
Yeah, that's something we laugh about on this show previously, is that it's not gay couples that are threatening straight marriage. It's probably divorce that's threatening straight marriage.
Well, and the French are always ahead of us in every, you know, when it comes to relationships. And they, civil unions in France now are bigger than, or more popular than marriages.
Yeah, well, see, there we have a thing or two to learn. Yeah, that was one of the quotes from the movie, which I... laughed at. One of the gentlemen in the movie said, gay men can do non-monogamy really well.
Exactly.
So now what do you hope that people do with this film? Because I've been thinking this film is a conversation starter.
Well, I hope it's, we do DVD extras as well. I mean, I'm hoping that gay guys that want to be in relationships or couples that are in relationships, having trouble or just, we'll have this as a how-to guide, that maybe they'll buy it or, give it to their friends, or I hope it's something that'll be on the bookshelf or the DVD shelf or something. It's a reference guide, there's a lot of experts in it, or they're couples. Hopefully some humor with aunt. It's entertaining.
Yes.
And so I'm hoping that this will be like, if gay men want to be in a relationship or they're having trouble in theirs, that they'll watch this and then, maybe get them thinking about what it takes or what they can do.
And what subject is coming up for you next? Again, my assumption is that the next documentary is on Vermont gay radio shows.
That's right. That's actually on the list.
Good.
Development.
Nice. Because I want it to be part of the box set.
I have a crack team on that right now.
I bet you do.
I'm actually doing some stuff specifically for Logo right now. I'm moving into kind of doing some programming for them there. And so I can't really say right now what
okay.
I'm working on, but it's going to be more kind of specific stuff. But I would like to do one. I'm on the side developing one about straight men and gay men's friendships.
Oh, nice.
How about the younger generation is much more open to having straight gay friends and, straight guys hang out with gay guys. They play on football teams together. They do all that. So kind of bringing us out of our ghetto and into mainstream.
Yeah. I was friends with a straight man once back in like 97.
Oh, really?
Okay. He seemed like a really nice guy.
Yes.
We could profile that. Now, where can folks go to learn all about the cool things that you're doing?
Well, there's websites for all of the films, mantomanmovie.com. And legalized gay movie. If you go to any of these websites, they connect to all of them. So mandemandmovie.com, legalizedgaymovie.com, thebutchfactor.com, theadonisfactor.com. So all the films have websites and clips and everything. So.
And certainly folks can go on over to Amazon, type in Man to Man, the number 2, and they can buy it right there.
Yeah, it'll be Man to Man, a Gay Man's Guide.
To Finding Love. Love it. Grindr and Manhunt, and you do talk about them in the films, and I was so appreciative that you did, because they really have changed the landscape of dating.
Well, I think it's incredible just how we connect, compared, like Grindr and Manhunt obviously kind of wrote the book for gay men on the internet as far as connecting sexually, and a lot of relationships have come from that site as well, but Grindr kind of, Joel Somkai, who's the first guy to come up using GPS and
yeah.
the phone to actually connect with people who are around you. I mean, he's the guy who came up with that. That's
right.
Gay or straight. That's driven by, gay men's always kind of using the latest technology, whether it's AOL chat rooms or, CompuServe or whatever or Manhunt to kind of find one another. Now he's doing, some straight GPS location kind of relationship thing, and that, that evolves Scruff. So, I mean, yeah, we're connected and everything. The only thing is it hasn't really led to more relationships.
Right.
The thing is it just playing to our, basic instinct of, finding a guy, you kind of flip through the thumbnails and, it's...
Those first impressions play a big role in all of this.
Well, I do want to remind people, it's amazing just over the last 10 years, the progress. And you talk to guys, from the 70s, 80s, even 60s. I mean, how isolated it was to be in... How closeted it was to be a gay man back in the day, just even 10, 20 years ago, and now, it's all out there and you've got it on your phone and you can connect with all these different people,
yeah.
it's been quite an evolution.
Yeah, no, it's changed the way that we're able to interact with other people and folks who were previously, again, in these rural places who had no contact with the gay community now have that as an outlet, and it's pretty big.
No, and I just think it's time also that now that we're coming, that we have to start being responsible and start acting, it's fun, it's good to have fun, it's, nothing, but I think, it's time for all of us to grow up and become part of mainstream society,
Exactly. 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 Well, as I said, this is a film, I just watched it. This is a film that is most certainly a conversation starter. So I encourage folks to go check it out, purchase it, watch it, and then bring someone else by, sit down with someone else and talk to them about it, because it really can start some valuable conversations. You're going to keep making more films, sir?
I am. I've been lucky, so I'm going to keep pushing forward.
All right. Well, we're going to have you back to talk. I'm so excited to have you back to talk about the whole Vermont Gay Radio Show documentary. And we'll put that right in the box set and we'll be all set, Christopher.
We will. I'm going to premiere it right on the show.
So. I would hope so. I'd be so insulted if it premiered someplace else. Christopher Hines, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Keep making these movies.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
All the best, Christopher.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Not a ton of time left on this week's show, but let's cover some gay news. I feel like we haven't talked about LGBT news in so long, so let's get to it. Well, everybody's talking about Kirk Cameron, 80s heartthrob Kirk Cameron, Mike Seaver from Growing Pains. My gosh, I watched a lot of episodes of Growing Pains. So Kirk Cameron was on the Piers Morgan show, and he was talking about how he feels that same-sex marriage is unnatural, and all these folks are up in arms, and there's actually this whole piece on advocate.com right now detailing all these 80s heartthrobs and 80s stars and how they feel about gay marriage. And so he certainly got people talking, and GLAAD and Kirk Cameron are going back and forth, and certainly, yes, I disagree with everything that Kirk Cameron said, but I also think this is Kirk Cameron. First of all, he has made a name for himself in the past decade or two of being a really conservative Christian commentator. Second, it's also Kirk Cameron. He's not much in the news. There's no way that the Piers Morgan show did not book Kirk Cameron on the show knowing he would say exactly this, knowing that he was going to get press. You don't book Kirk Cameron to promote his latest project on the Piers Morgan show because he's not really in the limelight anymore. So, I don't know. I'm feeling slightly cynical, slightly jaded about this story. And yes, condemning what Kirk Cameron said, and it's really silly. But at the same time, that was the whole point. I just saw this as a rating stunt. I'm faulting, in some ways, Piers Morgan and his show just as much as other folks. So, yes, cynicism. A little cynicism. I do it every now and then. That's okay. Now, in other news, education news, and you know I love to cover the education news, definitely want to spend some time talking about what's going on in Minnesota. Because there was a legal settlement between a Minnesota school district, this school district that we have talked about before on the show, that is under federal investigation, a legal settlement between this school district and a group of bullied young teens. And this settlement, many are calling just the blueprint for what schools need to be doing to protect youth in their community to address bullying. Now, yes, the school district had to come to this blueprint because they were being investigated, and we wish that folks would just be proactive, but that's also why we wanted to cover it on the show. I know we get emails all the time from educators, folks who are working in schools, not just teachers, but also school staff, who are a big part of the puzzle of addressing bullying in schools. And of course, from high school students who are saying, gosh, we know that our school has to change, but we're not exactly sure what we should propose. Well, this settlement between this school district in Minnesota and the government has a really nice blueprint for what it is that you should do. So the agreement between the six students, the school district, and the government is still subject to approval by a federal judge. Stipulated in the agreement is a $270,000 lump sum to be divided among the aggrieved students, as well as implementation of the following steps to address anti-LGBT bullying. And I want to cover all these because these are things that your school should be doing. And I should say, this is the Anoka-Hennepin School District. And so here it is. Here are all the bullet points. Number one, retain an expert consultant in the area of sex-based harassment to review the district's policies and procedures concerning harassment. Great. Number two, develop and implement a comprehensive plan for preventing and addressing student-on-student sex-based harassment at middle and high schools. Three, enhance and improve training of faculty, staff, and students on sex-based harassment. So important. Four, hire or appoint a Title IX coordinator, and your school is supposed to have a Title IX coordinator, everybody, to ensure proper implementation of the district's sex-based harassment policies and procedures and district compliance with Title IX. Five, retain an expert consultant in the area of mental health to address the needs of students who are victims of harassment. Great. Six, improve the district system for maintaining records of investigations and responding to allegations of harassment. That may sound really boring to you, but if we are not tracking these things, if we don't have really good records of the various investigations, the number of complaints that get lost in the shuffle, it's just staggering. Two more points. They have to conduct ongoing monitoring and evaluation of anti-harassment efforts. And finally, submit annual compliance reports to the departments. So that's just a great model of what schools can do. And you should do all of these things, and your school should not wait until you're under federal investigation to do them, because, you know, then you don't really look like a willing participant in all of this. It's better to do it when you don't have to, because all the schools actually should be doing this and not under the force of law because you're being investigated by the government. So I just want to put that out there. A lot of other fun news stories. There's a great piece, Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart, he addresses, which we've covered this issue so many times on the show before, of folks who are on both sides of the argument of whether or not we should be comparing the civil rights struggle for African Americans and for LGBT Americans. And some folks say these are not comparable, and other folks say, no, there's a lot of comparisons that can be drawn. And Jonathan Capehart actually said, quote, Both African Americans and gays have been targeted because of who they are. Both African Americans and gays have been denied equal access to the rights, responsibilities, and protections the Constitution provides. So he, Jonathan, is amazing. He is, I love his columns. He writes just incredible pieces that get you talking, that get you thinking. And so he wrote this piece, and you should go online, go on the Washington Post, and check it out. Now, we thought that at this point in the year, we would be talking about the Republican presidential nominee's views on LGBT equality, and indeed, it is past Super Tuesday, and we had it on the slate to talk about for this week, but it's not decided yet. It looks like it's going to be Mitt Romney, and we'll talk extensively if it is indeed a Mitt Romney. We will talk so much about his views, which are quite problematic about LGBT equality. When he agrees on one thing, he kind of flip-flops. That's what he does. But Rick Santorum, still in the picture. And if anyone, Stephanie Miller Show calls him frothy. I know a lot of people call him frothy. Well, again, what he has said, that this is a guy who is still in contention for the nomination for president of the United States by one of the major parties, given all of the horrible, horrible things that he has said about LGBT Americans, is I still can't believe in some ways that we live in a place where someone can say things like this and still be in contention. But again, that is a conservative base. That is part of our American landscape politics, even as I'm thinking about it right now. And it's quite frankly staggering. It's a little bit staggering. So we will keep you posted on that, and we will cover whoever the nominee ends up being. We'll be talking a lot. President Obama, he has responded to the Advocates Candidate Scorecard as part of questionnaires sent to all of the campaigns for president. President Obama provided a statement that lists his accomplishments on LGBT rights, but points to Congress as among the major holdups. He did not come out in support of same-sex marriage, and he still continues to get flack for that. He said in the past that his thoughts on the issue are evolving. He said, quote, "I believe that Section 3 of the so-called Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional and should be repealed. I have instructed the Department of Justice to no longer defend it in court, and the department has already filed multiple briefs supporting individuals challenging the law in court." And he ticked off a long list of changes his administration has managed to make without the help of Congress. He said, quote, "A lot of work remains, and we cannot wait for Congress to act." So he, President Obama, is certainly making his case to the LGBT community that he is the only one who will be supporting LGBT equality, and thus we should be supporting him. We will keep you posted on that. We'll see if any backlash comes out from the gay community. Many folks still very, very frustrated that he has not come out in favor of marriage equality. Again, even though he says his thoughts on the issue are evolving. So we do want to give a shout out. We love when we get picked up by new stations. So we would like to give a shout out to Wool, W-O-O-L, which is Black Sheep Radio, located in Bellows Falls, Vermont, And you can find us there on 100.1 FM. And they join all of our other stations, and you can stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com and click on stations. And if you don't see a local station there on stations, on our stations tab on the website, you don't see your local station there and you're just listening to us online, then drop your station an email and say, hey, you should have This Show Is So Gay, and go on over to thisshowisogay.com and learn all about them, because we want to hear them on our local station. We love that you guys can be our ambassadors for that. Of course, if you want us to do it, we'll do the work for you. Drop us an email at ken@thisshowisogay.com. We'll reach out to them and we'll get ourselves on your local station. We love doing the work for that. So definitely do that. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us. We like you. That's about all the time we have for this week's show. Next week, Dr. Frankie Bashan, relationship expert, we will be speaking with her as she returns to our show. If you have guest ideas, send those over to us too. You can post them on the Facebook wall or send them on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. We've got to get out of here for the week. Have an amazing, amazing rest of the week. Go do whatever it is you do to use your voice to make this world a better place. And while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? You
one single breath for granted.